Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way and the forthcoming book, How to Raise Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Today, we're talking with somebody who has the ability to bust through myths and debunk stereotypes about the practice of yoga and discuss how we might begin or re-engage with yoga at times when energetic resources are low, as well as how to practice honesty with family and friends when experiencing anxiety or depression. Susanna Neufeld is a licensed marriage and family therapist, certified yoga therapist, certified advanced emotion-focused family therapist, as well as certified eating disorder specialist and supervisor. She has been supporting people coping with eating disorders, body image concerns, anxiety, and maternal mental health since 2003. Susanna has a passionate interest in helping parents, caregivers, and partners of people with mental health issues. She co-founded the Rockridge Wellness Center, a counseling and health collective in Oakland, and speaks widely on topics such as eating disorders, body image, media literacy, perinatal mood disorders, and yoga therapy. She is the author of Awake at 3 a.m., Yoga Therapy for Anxiety and Depression in Pregnancy and Early Motherhood. Susanna, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Signe. It's so good to see you.
It's so good to see you too. Susanna, I just finished reading Awake at 3 a.m. and I feel like I may have had like a delayed grief response.
Aww.
As a new mother because I have a 12-year-old, but I was kind of on the verge of tears in a good way almost the whole way through the book. So thank you. And I want to say to our listeners too, even if you're not a new mother, there was something about just feeling so supported as a human being, just your openness about how we have dark thoughts and we have depression and we have anxiety. And I don't know, there was just something about it that was so validating. And I don't know if that's been other readers' experience.
Thank you, Signe, for saying that, because I think that was my dearest hope in writing this. And in some ways is the uniting factor in all the different things that I work with in my practice as a therapist. And what I try to do as a human being on this planet is to make space for dark stuff with love and with compassion. And gosh, that just means the world to me that you felt the vibe that I was putting out there and what my intention was in writing this. You know, it was really a book that I wish I had had. And I have heard that from other people who read it, that they felt, you know, like it was like a warm friend. I've also heard from people, they've said, you should write it again and make it not about early parenthood, or you should write it again and make it not about yoga, because I don't like yoga and I'm not a new parent, but... whatever phase they're like, I would have really liked to read the rest of it. So maybe I should find a way to repackage some of it. Because I know, you know, some people just don't like yoga, and that's okay. And yeah, to be able to get that compassion going their way too. Project for the future.
Even if you don't have a yoga practice or you're not a new mom, it's just, I don't know, being a human being and being reminded that you're not the only one that has dark thoughts.
Yeah.
You're not the only one who has feelings of depression or anxiety, because we all sort of seem, especially with social media, right? We look like we've got it all together and we don't.
We don't. No.
And it just feels so isolating to not know that other people feel the same way.
Yeah. And our current culture, I think, especially in the therapy world and certainly in the yoga world, it's very full of, I love the phrase toxic positivity. I don't know who coined that, but my hat goes off to whoever did, because I think we live in a world where we focus a lot on thinking positive and showing the brightest, most filtered versions of ourselves. And gosh, I'm more into the human aspects of things and connecting in our wholeness, which includes our pain and our messiness.
Mm-hmm. There was a line in the book that I really liked where it said that yoga is about softening, not solving.
Yeah. Signe, I feel so seen by you. I just have to say, it's so great to be sitting in person together after 2 years not seeing you or anyone.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I feel very seen by you saying that, because that is, you know, one of the things that I think I felt some hesitancy about writing about yoga, because I think people can sometimes think of yoga as like something they have to do or they should do that needs to be performed in a way, and then it will make them better. And then at the end of the practice, there's a judging of did it work or it didn't work. Same with therapy, right? Mm-hmm. Coming to therapy, did it work or did it not work? And I don't want anyone to have anything else on their to-do list, you know, like nothing else that we have to strive for or be better. Oh, I should be doing my yoga. Oh, I should be getting some exercise. I should be eating healthier. I should be doing this or that. Like, I don't want any of that. I certainly don't want to be the one to put any of that on anyone's plate. I offer the yoga as something if someone knows that this is something that feels nourishing to them, that lets them soften into themselves. For me, yoga has never felt good when it's like, I'm going to go do it as a workout, or I have to wear these certain mm-hmm. clothes, or I have to achieve some level of quote unquote advanced practice. I like it when it feels like, oh my gosh, this day is intense and I get to settle into this practice. It's a relief. It's not a break, because it's a tuning into myself, but it's a opportunity to just greet whatever is there without having to fix it, to have awareness of what's there and softening and compassion and spaciousness around it. That's where the physical practice comes in. It's like physically making space in my body for whatever is present. And that's what I like to offer to people, not with any shoulds, take it or leave it.
It's interesting because you're making me think of something back in the days of live yoga before COVID. I am somebody who personally really values challenge mm-hmm. later in life. I didn't when I was younger, but I don't know, when I entered into my 40s on, I really started to value challenge. But what's interesting is that when I used to go to yoga class in a studio, I just sort of naturally gave myself permission to not ever try a headstand or not even ever try to achieve it. I was like, I don't really feel like achieving that or trying to do it. And I'm just going to do child's pose over here while they're doing that. It was kind of interesting. Like, I was surprised to see that side of myself come out in the yoga room. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I love that. I mean, I think this is why you're so wonderful with teaching intuitive eating, right? Because it's a listening. It's an intuitive listening to what your lesson is or what you need to be working on right then, right? So sometimes we do have points in our lives where getting some mastery, right, over a pose is really helpful. So for example, you know, in yoga therapy, if somebody is having depression, it actually can feel really helpful to say, I've had this with clients where the main thing we worked on was handstands in therapy, because it is learning how to work on something hard without criticizing yourself, how to not give up, how to find the presence and the playfulness and the joy and the challenge and then the excitement as you get stronger and more able. And sometimes that's the task we have ahead of us that we need to work on. And sometimes we need to learn how to slow down, how to allow, how to not strive. And I mean, of course, we all need to work on all the things all the time, but I think that we tune into where we are out of balance and where we feel there's some satisfaction in moving in a certain direction or the other. So I love how you were able to notice that's not for me today. That's not going to enrich me or help me grow. Mm. It actually might even put more of a sharp edge to be striving towards those poses right now. Whereas for someone else, they might notice when they go in, hey, I'm scared of trying those things. And what would be really meaningful for me is to give myself permission to move slowly towards them. So I want that yoga practice or life practice to be really individualized, that no one need to compare themselves to how someone else is doing it, but really tune into what might be nourishing for them.
Susanna, I want to back up a little bit, and I'm wondering if you can tell us more about what it means to be a certified yoga therapist.
So first, I'll just say what yoga therapy is. A simple definition would be that it is the application of yoga for health and healing. which is how many people use it. But people also certainly, you know, use yoga for spiritual growth and for physical health and all kinds of things. Yoga therapy is applying it specifically for, you know, if you have conditions you want to heal from. And so a yoga therapist is someone who's trained through the IAYT, the International Association of Yoga Therapists, who's gone through a lot of training to become a yoga therapist. Typically, it's someone who's gone through both yoga teacher training and is licensed or registered or certified in another health discipline. So like I'm a psychotherapist. You could do it if you were a MD or you were a nurse or you were a physical therapist. We get extra training on how to combine the two things together for the benefit of the people that we work with. I guess it's to say you could go to a lot of people who are yoga therapists and they would all work on very different issues. So you might find a yoga therapist who works with back pain or yoga therapy for cancer. And then I wouldn't do either of those things. You know, I would help people with the things that my other work is engaged in. So, you know, mental health issues and pregnancy postpartum.
Okay.
Yeah.
And can you give us an example? So say somebody comes into your therapy practice and they are interested in also doing yoga therapy. What might that look like in the office with you?
Yeah, it can be so many different ways. It's been a long time since I've been in person with someone in an office. So it looked really different then than how it does now doing so much virtual therapy. But, you know, I think it really depends on what the agreement is with the person when they come, what they're asking for. I think some people come specifically wanting yoga therapy. They might even have an actual therapist that they see apart, and they'd like the entire session to be a yoga practice. That's less common for me than people who want regular talk therapy using, you know, a relational approach, CBT, et cetera. But they also want the yoga to be intertwined into that. And so that's more of what I do. So there will typically be, maybe we come in and we start by doing some meditation together or body awareness or grounding. And then sometimes they'll say, I just want to talk about stuff and explore for the rest of the session. And then maybe in reaction to what they're talking about, we choose some practices that we might do together or plan for them to do outside of the session. And then talk through the practice and afterwards to check in about what it feels like in their body, in their mind, in their heart.
Is there a certain pose that you might choose?
Yeah, it's always really... Yoga therapy is so hard to talk about. There's not like, here's the pose that I do with everyone. It really has to do with what they're presenting. And in fact, you know, that's a lot of what the book is about, is actually kind of figuring out what you need. So that's why so much of the talking part is kind of helping people explore what's happening. I always like going in my body, my mind, my heart, or heart meaning kind of your soul, your emotions, your spirit. What's going on with me and what do I need? So if somebody is feeling very depressed and very tired, depending on their energy, they might notice that it would help to do something more active to kind of bring up some energy. So we might do something like a more active breathing practice, or we might do like a warrior pose or something like pressing hands into the wall, like a plank on the wall kind of thing, or some sun salutations if they're really experienced and they like doing something active. Or they might feel so depressed that they feel like it's hard to move at all. So we might pick a restorative pose, which brings a little bit of discipline because we're doing a pose, but actually lets them rest and sink into. So it's, the discipline is in the structure of taking a pose, but the pose itself is entirely restful, no effort, no muscle strength required. And we actually try to make them as supported as possible with blankets and pillows and things like that, and allow them to really sink in and make space for the fatigue. So that's an example with depression, with anxiety, which certainly overlaps. So again, there's no hard and fast rules. It's co-created. Mm-hmm. But with anxiety, you know, it may be somebody who's coming and saying, hey, I'm stressed and I'd like something to help calm my nervous system down. And so we might do breathing practices like alternate nostril breathing or just things to slow the exhale down. And that might be all of what we're doing. Or we might, you know, do a restorative pose to like having legs up the wall that tends to relax the body. But for actually, I'd say a greater percentage of people who have high anxiety, the idea of doing something quote unquote relaxing is really either kind of almost traumatic or annoying. And they're like, I hate yoga.
Well said.
I'm anxious and you're telling me to breathe and lie down and I can't, like, I don't want to do that. And so with that person, actually doing something active might be much more helpful because it helps them get some of that energy out. And in yoga therapy, we call it rajas. You get some of that intense energy out by doing something active, maybe doing poses that have movement with them, like a dynamic pose, like what you might think of like cat-cow, or getting into a warrior pose and lifting in and out of it, or something where there's movement in the arms. So it gets some of the energy out, and that's actually what releases them to be able to feel more relaxed. So there's a process of inquiring into what's happening right now emotionally and in the body, and then responding to that, meeting oneself where you are versus having the sense that there's one right practice that they should be doing.
Are those examples too of how a person might begin or re-engage with a yoga practice at a time when energetic resources are low? Like maybe they are having a hard time outside of the session being self-directed. So they might come in to do that with you. Is that one way to think of it?
I think people can do this without a therapist there too.
Right.
You know, so I, you know, I don't have any magic powers, but I certainly, like, it's a playground. The therapy room is a playground to try some of these things. And yes, those are the exact practices that, you know, I support people in doing in their lives and seeing how they play out and how they feel for them. And yes, I think sometimes, you know, when people would think about having a yoga practice, they'd think, oh, well, I have to set aside an hour, 90 minutes. Mm. I have to roll out a mat. I have to wear, you know, fancy pants. I have to be really flexible. I have to have the right music on. I have to clean the room that I'm going to be in and have an altar with sage burning. I don't know, whatever ideas that people have based on our very strange culture we live in, you know, all of this has to be happening, but it's really not. And so, yeah, I really encourage people to come up with something that's the path of least resistance, that's short. Maybe the practice is only going to take 30 seconds or 3 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever feels motivating for them, or that they're interested in, that they can do in whatever they're wearing, right? In the book, you know, for new parents, they could do holding a baby, that people could do while they're sitting at their desk at work. Mm-hmm. That feels just, it doesn't have to feel like work. It feels there for them. It's there to support them. They can do it in the middle of a very messy room or whatever it is, and, you know, move from there. So yeah, these are exactly the practices I'll say. I'll really actually try to get people to be less ambitious about what they expect from themselves. You know, why don't we even just do something, like, if the word yoga is too intimidating, you know, let's just, can you stand up and stretch? You know, can you step up and just roll your hips around a little bit from side to side? Can you lie down and feel your breath in your body? And that's really, you know, the ability in that moment to take time to be present with your body and yourself, see what you need.
I like it because it also sounds like a micro goal. It sounds like something that you can achieve. It's small, you achieve it. And then I've been thinking a lot lately about the term about bi-directional activities, where you do a little small yoga pose, for example, just something that's not so daunting. And then it kind of lights a fire inside of you, like, ooh, that feels good. I want to do a little bit more, you know?
Yeah.
So it just sounds like such a nice starting place instead of like 90 minutes, you know, when you might not have the conditioning or you're feeling resistance anyway, or your energetic resources are low.
Yeah. Or you have to go to work or drive your kids somewhere or do. Yeah. Yeah. I want, you know, people to feel like there's healing practices they can do that are literally accessible to anyone and anybody. There's something for everyone.
Can you say more about the all natural mandate that you often see in holistic health communities?
Yes, the all natural mandate. Yeah, I think that people in any kind of, I mean, not just in holistic health, but I think that there can be this way of looking negatively at people taking medication. Sometimes they're called like happy pills, or gosh, I hear people say a lot like, this is taking the easy way out, or, you know, it's a crutch, or sometimes people will say, like, I'll just take the smallest dose possible. And yeah, I feel sad about that. And I don't think that, you know, I think I wanted to make the point about that in the book because I was worried that people would think, oh, you know, almost people would say to me, like, I'm doing yoga, but I'm sorry, I'm also taking medication. And I wanted to really open the door and say, there's room for both and all of the above. You know, medication can be life-saving for people. It's also not a happy pill. I've never seen someone right. start taking medication and suddenly feel happy. There are actually a lot of side effects. I mean, that's one of the reasons I think is the hardest to take, is because there are difficult things about taking it. And so people don't usually make that decision lightly. And when they do it, it's because they're trying to save their own lives. And I think we should applaud people for that and give them lots of compassion for doing whatever they need to do to kind of make their therapy work better. You know, the research really does show that people doing a combo of meds and therapy often do better than just the therapy alone. We sometimes ascribe moral value to, well, you know, we're familiar with this in the eating disorder world, right? Like, these foods are good foods, they're moral, they're healthier, they're, and then these foods are junk, and this medicine is not natural. And none of the things we have are fully natural, right? I just actually read this book, Sapiens, and there was one part talked about like how, you know, we sort of talk about food as coming from a specific place, and we think about, you know, like in Italy, they have tomato sauce, and in Switzerland, they have hot chocolate, and in India, they have foods with chili peppers. And they were like, well, actually, like, chocolate, chili peppers, and tomatoes all come from, you know, like where Mexico is. Like, they were all brought over in like the 1500s. None of them existed in India, or, you know, you wouldn't have found somebody in, you know, 1200 in Italy eating tomatoes. Like, we get these ideas about what's natural, what's, you know, authentic, and want to put things in good and bad categories. And actually, we can't get to those pure states. So anyway, a bit far afield of the topic of medication, but I am a fan of people doing whatever they need to do for themselves and having no shame about it, and feeling really welcomed to be exploring in that world. And all of that said, I wish we had better medications. I'm excited about what the world of psychedelic medicine is going to give people, but I just think medicine, herbs, whatever people can find, you know, let's open our arms to all the ways that people might find for healing.
Yeah, thank you for your mention of medication can be life-saving. I think it's a really, really important message. I also notice that, you know, sometimes people are not able to apply what they know, or they might be learning or working on in therapy, and medication can really help them apply what they know.
Yeah. Yeah. It just gives a little bit more softness to those places that we get stuck.
Yeah.
Oh, and one other point that I always want to make about meds is, you know, sometimes people think, well, I'll just take the lowest dose possible. But actually, if you're taking a dose that's low and isn't actually therapeutic, now you're having that medicine in your system and the depression or the anxiety at the same time.
Well said.
Which especially, you know, in pregnancy is like, it's actually something to think about. You know, when people are like, oh, I don't want to expose my baby to medicine. Like, well, now you're exposing them to both things, which, you know, I don't want anyone to feel bad about what they're exposing the baby to, but gosh, if you're going to take it, let yourself have the therapeutic dose. That's why you're taking it. Take it until you find out if it works or not. And then if you find a dose that works, you do not have to apologize for how much you're taking. It's not that someone taking a higher dose is like weaker than somebody taking a lower dose. It's just, we all metabolize things differently. Our bodies all work differently, and we're all going to need a different dose of everything. Yeah. Medicine, music, food, sleep. We all need different things.
I think that this whole quote unquote natural mandate, all natural mandate that you speak of, is so culturally sanctioned.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like there's not so much awareness of that. You know, I see it sometimes, and I don't mean to judge it, but I see just all this identification of all natural. And because of treating eating disorders, we both treat eating disorders, we see how that can go really, really wrong. And it just makes me, want to have McDonald's. And I do anyway. I'll probably edit that out or maybe not. Susanna,
you don't have to edit it out, right? I mean, and it's like, I think, actually, I don't know if it made it into the book, but I made some joke about how you could have like your sugar cereal with organic strawberries on top. Like, it's okay if you also really like organic things and all natural things. I tend to be like that stuff. I've been in California probably too long, you know, but I think, like, let's all just be okay with what fits and what works, and then in tune with what works for each of our own selves in our own lives.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Susanna, you specialize in perinatal mood and anxiety disorders.
Yeah.
Can you tell our listeners what that is?
So often when people are pregnant or have a baby and then they have depression, they'll say, I had postpartum. And it's totally a misnomer, because postpartum just means like the period after having a baby. So anyone who had a baby has postpartum. What they are often referring to is postpartum depression, but the actual clinical term we use now is perinatal, not postpartum, because perinatal refers to the entire time period. Many, if not most of the people who have quote unquote postpartum depression actually have symptoms during pregnancy, or even during a fertility process they might be going through, and then it can last long after. So perinatal refers to that entire time period. And then we now say mood and anxiety disorders, because actually anxiety during pregnancy and postpartum is more common than depression.
Okay.
And so we say put them all together, perinatal mood and anxiety disorders.
You speak about your own experience with perinatal mood and anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
And what really struck me is that when it was happening for you, it was very acute, but because you were so aware of it, you knew what was happening.
It's funny that you say that, because I don't think I did at first, actually, especially as a therapist, right? It's much easier to see something in someone else than to see it in yourself. So I think when you're suffering, you know, one of the thoughts I had that I see in so many people I have is just like, something is wrong with me. I'm suddenly a really grumpy person. I'm not a good enough mom. Everyone else is able to parent and work and, you know, wear cute clothes and go for a hike and do all these things. And how come I'm bad at all of it at the same time? My family deserves someone better. My baby deserves someone better. The people I work with deserve someone better. And it takes a while, I think, to be able to see that that's not the truth, that that's a story, you know, that we sort of form because we don't have words for what's going on. And it was hard for me to admit to myself that that was happening, because I saw myself in the role of helping other people through that. It was both a relief when I realized that that was what was happening, and, you know, very painful as well. Also, you know, an interesting piece for me was that I did not have it during my first pregnancy. Well, I actually had some depression during the pregnancy because I was very sick. I had hyperemesis, like throwing up a lot, and it was really awful. And so I was so relieved when that pregnancy was over, and I was really happy during that time period. It was a lot easier. And then after my second pregnancy, we had moved. We lived in a new place where I didn't have as much community around. And it's much harder when you have two people to take care of. It's exponentially more work. I was sort of shocked, you know, I couldn't just sit and, you know, blissfully breastfeed in the morning. I had to take care of both kids, and I wanted to do right by both of them. I just felt so deeply in love with both, and I wanted to give them both all of me. And I was just much more exhausted that second time. So I wasn't familiar with what was happening to me from the inside out. It took a little while to understand and then to figure out how to greet that.
Actually, I'm just realizing that I don't know if you specialized in perinatal mood and anxiety disorders before your pregnancy.
You did.
Okay.
I mean, eating disorders has always been, you know, the main part of my practice. But I think around the time that I was interested in getting pregnant, I noticed I had more and more clients with eating disorders going through pregnancy and postpartum because, you know, people with eating disorders are people and lots of people get pregnant. And so I had wanted to get extra skills to kind of help them through that time period. Mm-hmm. And that was, again, around my first pregnancy. And I was also really loving prenatal yoga and finding it to be a balm for me in my pregnancy. And so I decided to get trained in prenatal yoga. And that made me interested in, you know, putting that as one of the things I specialized in, which then made me go get more and more training in it. And so, I was working with people who had that, you know, before and of really suffering with it myself. You know, for anybody listening to this, that, you know, therapists are people too. Mm-hmm. And therapists might be listening to this. And sometimes we think we're not supposed to have our own mental health struggles, or there's this kind of frustrating thing sometimes said to therapists of like, you can only take people as far as you've gone, or, you know, I think we're people and we're just sort of sitting alongside our clients and helping them walk through their own process and offering them care and compassion. But we go through our own things and that's okay.
We're human
and that's delightful. So just for anyone listening, you know, also to know sometimes when you have a mental health issue, you might think to yourself, I certainly did, like, how could I have let this happen? I knew all the things to do ahead of time to prevent this thing from happening. Or why am I so stupid that this has come up? Which is definitely, if you have that thought, that's a sign of depression, you know, but important to say that knowing is not necessarily going to prevent the thing from happening, with, especially with perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. Hormones are such a big part of it, and sleep deprivation. You can know, but use the knowing to set up support for yourself, not to judge yourself if it shows up, you know.
Right.
All we can do is deal with whatever is there and have compassion for ourselves and the people around us.
Okay. And as you say in the book, therapists go to therapy.
Yes.
Therapists go to therapy. Yeah. I go to therapy. Yep. I'll always
go
to therapy.
Me too.
Yeah, it's at least
best.
Once a month. I love it so much. So can you say more about practicing honesty with family and friends?
Yeah, right. It's these interpersonal effectiveness skills of kind of not expecting people to read our minds and being able to ask. And certainly we can say it with a way that lets them off the hook. So we're not like, hold my baby or I'm going to fall apart, you know, but it could be being able to just say to someone, hey, like, no problem if the answer is no.
Right.
But here are a couple of things that would be helpful to me that you could do. And helping people feel like they know what that list is of things that would be helpful to identify blocks they might have to asking for those things, maybe shame or embarrassment that might come up. And then also, I mean, one of my things that I really love is to help, I think we talked about it before, to help the caregivers, help their friends, help their family, help their partner know how to offer that support.
To know how to offer it. It's a really, like you said in the book, don't ask me what I need in an open-ended way.
Yeah. So I will often coach, you know, the loved ones to say something like, hey, here's what I'm going to do. And if you don't want that, just let me know. But like,
I'm going to drop a meal off at your, you know, at your doorstep at 5 p.m. Is that okay?
Yeah, exactly. Because what happens, especially in the age of texting, you know, we'll be like, hey, I'm thinking of bringing you something. Is that okay? And they're like, yes, it's okay. And you're like, okay, would you like this? Or do you want this? Or do you want this? Or is there a restaurant that you like? And then by the time, I don't know, my experience when people would do that to me was I'd just be like, this is too stressful.
Right.
I don't even want to pick my phone up anymore.
Right.
You know? So it's, I think that it's really helpful when you're offering help to say, to offer something specific and then, you know, to give a caveat, if that doesn't work or there's something you want more, let me know. To just let the person, you know, they don't have to feel pressured into getting that help. If we take the baby example of it off, you know, and we're talking to just somebody who's feeling depressed and wants a friend to be able to be there for them, but knows that sometimes when they're with a friend, they feel like they're just pulling them down into a hole. And so they don't want to have to talk about all the things that are depressing. You know, that the friend could just say to them like, hey, I can come and we can just watch a TV show together. I can come, we can take a walk and we don't have to talk about anything serious, or we can talk about the most serious thing, whatever you want. And that'll
be that.
It can be concrete and lots is it of permission.
Okay? Concrete and is it okay?
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
And things like invite me out for a walk and get me out the door. Help get me out the door. Just concrete examples.
Yeah.
I've just found it so useful.
Yeah.
All of my clients that'll be listening to this week will know that we're working on the list. But I have everyone doing it. It's just a list that I think is so applicable
everyone.
Saying
that. Yeah. Someone told me that I should make it into like laminated things to be given out at, at like OB offices, which I've never managed to get that together. But I do think it's nice. It'd be good for people to think about how they can let other people know how to support. And people love being able to support another
person. Yeah, because they want to help. They want to help and they don't know how. And so, yeah, anyway, it just really stood out to me. Well, Susanna, thank you so much for your personal honesty in your book and for the work that you do, for your compassion and commitment to offer support in dark times.
Yeah. Thanks, Signa. This has been, I could talk to you for
I could talk
10
to
more
you.
Hours.
I could talk to you for 10 more hours.
Yeah.
And as they say at the end of my favorite yoga class, the light in me honors the light in you.
Oh.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We'll see you next month.